Hello, Kate Lamb here, and you're listening to Asia Calling. Coming up on the show this week, we delve into Australia's mother tongues, take a look at India's drug problem, and visit the spicy side of Indonesia. Welcome to Asia Calling, and thanks for tuning into the show. Many of us have sat in a classroom and learnt a language other than our mother tongue. And that's exactly where this next story takes us, into a classroom in Sydney, where Australians are starting to learn one local Aboriginal language. It's all part of a growing movement to help revive and save the almost 120 Aboriginal languages that are spoken in Australia today. Jani Bakali has this story.
Bujari Mulinawal. Good morning. It's a Saturday morning and I'm heading to a language class to learn some Darug. It's the language spoken by many of the Aboriginal clan groups in and around the area we now call Sydney, and part of one of the oldest living cultures in the world. There are roughly 120 Indigenous languages still spoken today, and many of them, like Darug, are being revived.
Wayanga?
Wayanga? Wayanga?
Bayanga?
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 Mother?
Father.
There are roughly a dozen people in this class. Retirees, high school teachers, an electrician. Auntie Jacinta Tobin has been teaching Aboriginal culture, songs and ceremonies for almost 20 years. And she says it's been heartening to see the increasing interest in learning Aboriginal languages from the broader community.
Really grateful that people are wanting to learn. And I heard some Australians saying it's a dead language and that. And it's only because we don't understand the science behind it.
There were roughly 250 languages spoken throughout the continent when the British colonised Australia. But through the violence of colonisation, more than half were lost.
A lot of Australians or the world don't realise that we weren't allowed to speak the culture, speak the language. And so, you know, sometimes people think, oh, we were too lazy to teach our kids language. But that's not true. Just it was a fear of your child being taken.
Of the 120 Indigenous languages remaining, almost 100 of them are in danger of becoming extinct, as it's mostly the elder members of the community who know them. That's led to a recent push to save them, and technology is playing a big part of it. Several smartphone apps have been developed for kids to learn Indigenous languages, as well as online courses and classes like this one. One of those attending the classes is Tash Caldwell. She works for a local government, and she's Indigenous herself. Her people come from the northern state of Queensland, and she missed out on learning her language.
I didn't actually get a chance to learn language growing up from my own mob, so I just thought it was a good opportunity to learn the local language where I'm living. And to be honest, it's probably encouraged me to try and find ways to do that, to get in back in touch with some of my mob who do actually speak fluent language.
Romina is from Italy and, like many Europeans, is backpacking around Australia. She joined the class to learn more about Aboriginal culture.
We don't know anything about Australia in Europe, like anything at all. So I just started to read something about Australian history and how it began, the colonization and everything. And I was really surprised about the fact that I have the feeling you cannot really see around any sign of the past, and yeah.
And how many languages can you speak?
And I like languages. I speak Italian, Greek, Spanish, and English. Yeah.
However, for Australians, speaking a second language is rare. It's estimated more than 80% of Australians only speak English. And while the government is hoping to increase the number of kids who speak a foreign language, many Indigenous groups are pushing for Aboriginal languages to be taught in schools as well.
I'm Joel Davison. I'm a Gadigal man, and I've grown up all around Sydney.
Gadigal is one of the several Aboriginal tribes that traditionally lived in the area around Sydney. Joel only began learning Darug 3 months ago, and is now teaching the class along with Jacinta. He usually works as a web developer, but language is something he's becoming passionate about.
You can't detach language from the culture and the history, and I'm very passionate about teaching the culture and history of the Sydney Aboriginal people and all Aboriginal people.
He says he hopes young Aboriginal people growing up will have the opportunity that he didn't. Do you feel like it was disappointing to not know growing up?
Yeah, it definitely was. You know, it's embarrassing to tell people that you don't know your own language. It's embarrassing to see people who, because they don't know their own language, they don't know their own culture and history, they don't have anything to be proud of as Koori people.
Aboriginal people make up 2.5% of the Australian population, but it's not known how many speak their traditional languages. Generally, it's a lot less common for Indigenous people living in the big cities, like Sydney. Joel says that with half of the Aboriginal population under the age of 20, now is the time to start teaching.
So come together, learn all our lore. Let's come together and heal this land that's ours.
Being able to give the young ones their language back and being able to have them grow up with it, which is something that I wasn't able to do, would be the best gift in the world.
For Asia Calling, this is Johnny Blackali in Sydney, Australia.
Contraception, condoms, and sex education. For decades, they have sparked controversy and debate in the deeply Catholic nation of the Philippines. But bucking trends, President Rodrigo Duterte recently issued an executive order, one that is allowing government agencies to distribute free contraception. Madonna Varola and Mariel Gargola have this report on the rollout from Davao City in the southern Philippines.
Nanantaas po taog turnout sa numbers kasi
local population officers here in Bunawan Village are talking to mothers who have turned up for free contraceptives. 28-year-old Melanie is among the crowd and says she wishes the choice to have a contraceptive implant fitted had come a decade earlier.
Dose pa mangugo na minyo, minyos kumbana. 3 years sa munggap.
Melanie fell pregnant at the age of 12. She wanted to keep studying, she says, but did not have a choice.
Eskwela pagyad ka na dapat nga idarahan ng trabaho kong papa.
Now she has 4 children and her husband, who works seasonally on mango farms, are struggling to afford to send them all to school. Jerry Lynn Lewis, one of the population officers here, says she often sees similar cases with a range of factors at play in teen pregnancies, from poverty to pop culture.
And even cartoons may subdued na sexual elements or violence. It comes in pairs, drugs, sex, and violence. It's in the TV, it's in the, even in the cartoons. You can witness that. So maybe early exposure connects to the early practicing of the young kids. And to add, there was even an incident wherein the daughter is only 15 and the mother was in late 30s. They both had a implant insertion the same day because her daughter is already mother of two.
Population officers like Jeff Fuentes have welcomed President Duterte's executive order, which advocates family planning and related services.
Addressing the unmet need is actually tantamount of addressing multiple issues. Issues like maternal death, infant death, in pregnancy.
He says it's alarming. The Philippines has one of the highest rate of teenage pregnancy in the region. Data from the National Demographic Health Survey in 2013 showed 1 in 10 Filipino women aged between 15 and 19 had begun childbearing. A month before the president's executive order, the health department announced plans for rights-based sex education in schools and to distribute condoms in public high schools. It has not gone down well with the Catholic Church. Here's priest Jerome Ceciliano.
They have been distributing condoms before, but did the numbers decrease? Seems not. It even looks like it's increasing. We understand that they need to show they are doing something as an institution to address these issues. But maybe the government can do other things rather than distribute condoms.
The health department, after talking to parents, has decided to leave condom distribution to local health centers, but they are sticking to plans to implement comprehensive sex education in schools. Contraception and sex education have long been sensitive issues in the Philippines. For example, it took Congress 12 years to pass the Responsible Parenthood and Reproductive Health Act of 2012. Anti-abortion groups rallied hard against it. It even went to the Supreme Court last year, which ended up banning the distribution of contraceptive implants. Reproductive health advocate Laika Sarenas of Oxfam International explains.
To date, the most serious challenge is the Supreme Court decision to deny the government's motion to lift the temporary restraining order on public promotion, procurement and distribution of select family planning commodities.
The Temporary Restraining Order, or TRO, legally prevented the government from distributing contraceptive drugs, devices, and contraceptive implants. But the president's executive order and the recent Supreme Court clarification has turned this around. It means contraceptive implants and other forms of contraception can now be distributed by government workers, provided the supplies were not procured with government funds. And local government health workers like Jerry Lynn Levis can continue to counsel their clients about their reproductive choices.
Bahala sila sa ilang tinuhuan, na mapugoy ako ang sarili tinuhuan.
While there is still strong resistance from the church, young mothers like Melanie hopes her practical decision will be respected. With Mariel Garjola in Davao City, this is Madonna Virola for Asia Calling.
You're listening to Asia Calling on KBR. India's northern state of Punjab is known as the Granary of India. But in recent years, the state has emerged as a fertile ground not just for crops, but drug abuse. Now, with the assembly elections in five states, including in Punjab, underway, the drug problem is dominating the campaign. Bismillah Gilani has this story.
35-year-old Dheeraj Singh lives in Punjab's Firozpur district. Until a few years ago, he went to the gym every day with dreams of becoming a professional weightlifter. But his life took a turn for the worse when he became addicted to heroin. Now he can barely lift his own body weight.
I was against all of these things. In fact, I used to help people come out of it. But my friends often insisted that I try it once, and when I finally did, I like it. A few times more, and you are addicted. That's what it does.
Every time Singh tried to give up the addiction, he ended up plunging deeper into it, and his debts kept piling up.
Only an addict knows what happens when you don't get the daily fix. It's terrible. Red watery eyes, running nose, and frightening palpitations. So strong is the urge that one can go to the extent of committing a crime. He can even murder someone for money.
Punjab gets its name from the five rivers running through it. But in recent years, it has been mostly known for what many call the sixth river, says social activist Brij Bedi.
The entire state is engulfed by drugs, especially the youth. The problem is so huge that it has become like a river. Everybody here talks of the sixth river. It is this river of drugs and addiction.
According to the government, two out of three households in rural Punjab have at least one drug addict in the family. The situation isn't any better in urban areas, where drugs are more readily available, and it has left a long trail of pain and misery. Maqbulpura village in Amritsar district epitomizes the suffering the state has been through. It is called the village of drug widows because in almost each of the 400 families living here is at least one widow of a drug addict. 45-year-old Mandeep has already lost her husband to drugs and now fears for her son, who is also a drug addict. She hasn't seen him for months.
What can a mother like me do except cry and curse my destiny? They do drugs and suffer as long as they live, and one day they die living a shattered and crying day and night. Ultimately, it is woman who bear the brunt of it all. I can't go out to earn and feed him. Neither is he able to work.
Most of the opiate drugs plaguing Punjab originate in Afghanistan and make their way into India through Pakistan. Some accuse Pakistan of using drugs as a form of proxy war to destabilize India. Border security guards are vigilant, but the drug trade continues to flourish, and many also accuse the ruling establishment of providing patronage to drug peddlers. Bhagwant Mann is a parliamentarian from Punjab.
Kashmir also shares a border with Pakistan and it is not even fenced, and so does Rajasthan. But we haven't heard of anyone in Kashmir or Rajasthan using smack. Why is this the problem only in Punjab? It is because the politicians and people in the administration are in fault.
Raids on factories have also shown there is a problem with synthetic drugs in Punjab, and in some cases, police involvement in drug rackets. For a long time, the local government remained in denial about the magnitude of the problem. It took a Bollywood film last year and some political campaigning after that to bring the problem to national focus. Now it's the main issue on which the current assembly election in the state is being fought. All political parties in the fray have promised to eradicate the drug menace once they come to power. Who the voters have found more convincing will become clear early next month, when the election results will be announced. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Finally on Asia Calling, from the rich peanut sauce of gado gado to the spicy tang of nasi goreng, or fried rice, Indonesian cuisine is known for its intense flavours and lavish use of spices. A new book, Seni Rasa, is a companion to Indonesian cooking that captures the distinctive flavours of Indonesian food and breaks them down, one ingredient at a time. Nicole Kirby caught up with author Rima Sejokri at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival to find out more.
1501, pau 1, singong 1, 3000.
The streets of any Indonesian town or city are full of the sound and smell of food, often cooked on the spot and sold for less than a dollar a plate. But the convenience and cheap prices is also one reason that Indonesian home cooking is becoming harder to find these days.
I'm not a great cook. I'm not a good cook. I'm not even probably a cook. I'm a non-cook like most people, but I am very...
Rima Sejokri says she isn't a great cook, not even a good cook. She never learnt when she was young. And she says she's not the only one.
Basically, I feel like my generation is the missing link in Indonesian cooking because we were raised to have a career outside of the home. We were raised to go beyond kitchen. our kitchen, you know, to just reach out high up there. But funnily enough, it was also work that took me back to the kitchens. But the kitchens that I'm talking about is other people's kitchens, mm-hmm. and a lot of them. So,
Rima has dedicated herself to recording recipes and secrets from inside kitchens all over Indonesia. And she's put them together in a book launched earlier this month, which shares the principles of Indonesian cooking.
Do you remember, like, we probably have all in our past have heard about grandma cooking with our mothers in the kitchen, and she would be telling our mothers in terms of how things work in the kitchen and how things work in their recipes. Well, nowadays we probably don't have as much advantage of that. So this book is basically kind of like that, you know, playing that role in today's world, where basically where we live separate from our mothers, probably earlier than our parents did.
Indonesia is a vast and diverse country, with more than 300 languages and 900 inhabited islands. From place to place, food varies wildly. Each area has its own set of specialties, from gudeg or jackfruit curry in the central Javan town of Yogyakarta, to beef rendang in West Sumatra. Food is a crucial part of local culture and identity. But Rima says it is geography that determines different flavours and methods of cooking.
When doing this book, what I did was basically I collected about over 1,000 recipes from around Indonesia. And what I found was that on the western side of Indonesia, like Sumatra, Java, we do a lot of more of boiling. And on the eastern side of Indonesia, we do a lot more of grilling. And that is actually has to do with the geography of where we are. Because on the western side, the water reservoir is a lot. The freshwater reservoir is a lot more available. And on the eastern side, you know, given the islands are thin and all, we have more seawater than freshwater, they have no choice but to grill.
But it's the use of spices, or bumbu, that is common across the archipelago and that defines Indonesian cooking.
The artful part of our cooking lies in the grinding of basic spices together to make various blends of bumbu, because I think this bumbu part is probably the most authentic part that we can claim to be ours, Indonesian cooking.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, what do you think defines Indonesian cooking?
I think this mix, this blending of bumbu would be it, because otherwise we all borrow techniques from elsewhere, like the stir fry comes from China and the fermentation comes from China also, or the curry, the pasting comes from India or Persian, you know, but the bumbu itself is probably, the blending is probably ours.
It's no coincidence that spices are so fundamental to Indonesian cooking. Spices like cloves, pepper, cinnamon and nutmeg are endemic to Indonesia, and they have shaped the history of the place, which was once known as the Spice Islands. Dutch and Portuguese colonisers fought for domination of Indonesia's islands, exploiting the area and people so that they could sell the lucrative spices to build their empires. The flavour of Indonesian food these days owes a lot to colonial-era trade.
There's something funny about the spices, because the spices that are homegrown, like that is native to here, like clove, nutmeg and cinnamon especially, those are the three spices key that people were looking for here. And yet, if you look into our recipes, those were the spices that are least used in our recipes. Mm-hmm. Instead, we use chilies a lot. You know, the sambal and all. But chilies mm-hmm. were not from here. Chilies came here in the 16th century, you know, like when the Portuguese came. And yet, we have adopted it so well.
In this steamy, tropical climate, specific combinations of spices are used to preserve food and to kill bacteria. Take beef rendang, for example. When family members leave their villages in West Sumatra to find work in the cities, they would be sent off with beef rendang in a lunchbox. And even in the heat, the meaty dish would last them the several day-long journey to the city. These days, it's not unknown to send beef rendang to family by mail. For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in Ubud, Bali.
That That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling. You can now also podcast the show, go to the iTunes Store and search for Asia Calling. I'm Kate Lamb, back next week with more stories from Asia.
You have to love me, you're so special.